All right, welcome to a breakout session about nothing. I'm going to open with reading a quote from a guy named Bill Wyman, no relation to the Stones bassist. He's a great journalist, and he wrote an article about Seinfeld, which I think is probably the best piece I've read on Seinfeld in preparation for this session. I read, there's actually not enough books written about Seinfeld yet, but I think there will be. But there is enough to fill a small bookshelf. And still, Wyman's take is what I found to be the most interesting. And this is from a guy who's a high culture person. He is a cultural critic and a thinker and a person that was not a fan of network television, especially not of situation comedies. He would be, consider himself to be sort of above that. And yet he found himself late to the game, becoming exposed to this thing called Seinfeld, and realizing that it might be the great, the Sistine Chapel of our times. That's how he actually put it. And this guy, with a straight face, he said that Seinfeld might go down as the most important and sort of perfectly executed, pristine cultural artifact of its time. And by of its time, I mean Seinfeld ran from 1989 to 1998. And, you know, it went through many phases. But it is called the show about nothing. And they famously, Jerry and George, the two characters, they make fun of the creation of the show as being a show that they pitched to NBC within the fourth season. It's very, you know, Seinfeld loved doing sort of meta self-commentary and self-referencing. And they talk about it, oh, we're going to do a show about nothing. About nothing. And sort of they're adamant about how trivial it will be. And of course, this is the great irony about Seinfeld, is it is about nothing, but it's about everything. It was originally pitched as a show that would follow Jerry Seinfeld as he kind of had the experiences that led him to create his material, his stand-up, and then at the end of the show, there would be a stand-up, and you'd see him making jokes. It's how a comedian gets his material. And it quickly morphed into just the life of these four characters, the brilliantly intersecting every single episode, usually three to four storylines about Elaine, the woman who's actually sort of the alpha male of the group. There's Kramer, who's the doofus, but the hipster, and is a lot of the physical humor, and but also occasionally comes out with something extremely truthful or wise, usually at the wrong moment. Then there's Jerry, the sort of everyman, detached from the world, funny, sort of, you know, the anchor, the eye of the storm around which these three other characters revolve, but not without his own problems, of course. But usually casually detached, unemotional. And then there's George Costanza, who I consider to be sort of the modern incarnation of St. Peter. George Costanza being a person who falls on his face time and time again. Exactly what Michael Horton was talking about this morning, a person who is trying to control themselves and their world, and it always backfiring in extremely funny ways. And George was based on the co-creator of the show, Larry David, who many of you maybe know now from Curb Your Enthusiasm. But Larry, actually a lot of these experiences that seem so far-fetched, as in sort of lying your way, staking out a woman's apartment in order to lie your way to get up there to change out the answering machine tape so that she wouldn't hear the terribly embarrassing answering machine message that you left the day before because she's been out of town, meeting her at her apartment to head her off at the pass. He actually did that. You know, actually, when you find out the opposite episode, which is probably the great work of Seinfeld anthropology, where George decides to do that everything he's ever done was the wrong decision. So if he does the opposite, all of his inclinations are the wrong ones. So if he does the opposite, then they must be the right ones. And that's one of the great, we've talked about that at length on our website. But I said I was going to read this guy's take to open us up here. Even joking about how Seinfeld is about nothing, few actually spent time examining what the show was really about. What that something was obvious but nonetheless disturbing. Could the show have been made, or could two characters in an actual sitcom have gotten away with designing a new show about what Seinfeld is really about? Something that bleak, that uncompromising, and once proposed, could its creators have been allowed to drive home that thesis with the densest underpinning in the history of the medium, something almost play-like in its attention to details, thematic denseness, and near poetic devotion to its theme? Could they have said, that is, we'd like to do a situation comedy about man's inhumanity to man? The petty desires, the errant cruelties, the lack of perspective, the meaningless hostility, the lack of commitment, of sympathy, the confusion, the hostility, the isolation, the impossibility of love, the futility of even attempting to break out of the molds we've stuffed ourselves into. Now that is a bleak thing, but that is what we see in Seinfeld. And many of us watch it twice a day, every single day. Because TBS, thank God, has it on right the hour from 7 to 8, this in Charlottesville, Virginia, right after the kids go to sleep and right before other things happen. 7 to 8. I watch two episodes every single day. So I wonder, you know, if how much my personality has actually been formed by Seinfeld, because I've had such a steady dose. I have more steady dosage of Seinfeld since far before I was considering the Bible seriously. This has been my discipline. I was a kid in boarding school who had VHS tapes of 17 episodes that I taped manually, making sure the commercials weren't taped, because I just thought this stuff was so funny. And of course, you know, we feel understood by Seinfeld. That's one of the reasons why Larry David, in interviews, he's always saying that people always ask him, are you really like that? The character he plays on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Are you really like George Costanza? And he says the reason his appeal is, he thinks his the reason for his appeal is that he does and says all the things that people are thinking, but they don't do, or they wish they did. And there's something that where we feel known by Seinfeld, and we can laugh at ourselves in Seinfeld. I find, although we, you know, Wyman talks about man's inhumanity to man, and the errant cruelties of life that it depicts, that it's actually, whether Larry David or Jerry Seinfeld meant to or not, that's actually a very compassionate show, because it depicts us as these sort of helplessly self-centered repeat offenders stuck in these patterns, but that there's something, we can laugh at that. And a lot of people would say there's something deeply nihilistic about Seinfeld, because the motto, the well-known motto behind Seinfeld was no hugging, no learning. You probably knew this. They said that the one rule is there will be no hugging, so they'll never get sentimental or emotional. Or if they do, something will snap them out of it. And there'll be no learning. Now that's a view of human nature that is very dark. But it's also the reason why it's so funny. So I've quoted this on the website before, but I feel that the W.H. Auden's, I've been getting a lot of mileage out of him recently. He talks about Christian comedy. He said, Christian comedy is based upon the belief that all men are sinners. No one, therefore, whatever his rank or talents, can claim immunity from comic exposure. And indeed, the more virtuous, in the Greek sense, a man is, the more he realizes that he deserves to be exposed. Now, there's nothing, I mean, I would never argue that Seinfeld has something, a Christian spirit about it. I mean, it's emblematic of sort of, or at least if the essays are to be believed, it's emblematic of a secular Jewish mindset. That's how they talk about it often. But this view of human nature as being one that people don't really change, and people are their own worst enemies, that is not just Jewish, that is Christian. That's Judeo-Christian. And it's the starting point that Aaron talked about last night for people to understand God's grace. A grace that reaches you despite yourself and despite your efforts to block it. What else does Seinfeld say about life? It says that the bulk of life does not exist in work. You'll notice that professional life in Seinfeld is very rarely, I mean, Elaine's jobs are just, she goes from one to the next. I mean, the J. Peterman catalog, you can just laugh thinking about it. It's not taken seriously. And she goes Pendant Publishing. She's the only one that appears to actually have a steady job. George Costanza goes, I mean, nothing about what happens at work has anything to do with work for him. Right? Kramer doesn't work. And Jerry is a comedian who doesn't seem to be all that interested in being a comedian. And is constantly actually making fun of the very profession. So the bulk of life is not work, it's relationships. And I think that's true to experience. Our relationship with ourself, our relationship with other people, especially our relationship with romantic relationships. And the search for love and for intimacy literally lies at the center of the human experience. But in Seinfeld, true love, true understanding is always out of reach. It's always eluding them. And that's what makes it so funny, and it makes it perfect for an episodic situation comedy. And that may not be, you know, a lot of us, you know, people do find love and fulfillment in life. Seinfeld is not reality. It is a comic fantasy. But it is true that our desire to be loved, to love and be loved, really does occupy a lot of our waking life. And the next very important thing that the Seinfeld reveals is that the little things are the big things in life. The trivial, the phrase that the academics use is the significance of the insignificant. That we're actually not waking up in the middle of the night thinking about world hunger. We're waking up in the middle of the night replaying a tiny conversation about something minuscule about which we're inferring an enormous truth about ourselves or the world. That those tiny moments are actually what occupy us. The significance of the insignificant. The things that drive a good or a bad day. Getting a parking ticket. Having a positive interaction or a negative interaction with a waitress or a waiter, a bartender. These, you know, loaning a friend, paying for his coffee. That these are the important things in life. Now, again, there's a nihilistic element to that. Politics in this show are laughed at. Anyone taking pretty much anything seriously is laughed at. Yet at the same time, the great irony of Seinfeld is that the show was clearly taken very seriously. They labored over it. These are some of the most tightly written scripts ever produced. Every single one that you watch, there's I would say out of all the Seinfeld episodes, there's about three or four that aren't good. You know, there's three or four that I'll turn off when they come on. But otherwise, I watch them all over and over again. The way they intersect, the way that you pick up new things every time. The attention to detail, not only the significance of the insignificant, is evidenced in the sort of artistic and the creativity of this show. And it's astounding. You kind of look back at it and you're like, oh my gosh. Yes, it's dealing with man's inhumanity to man, but in such a beautiful way. How can the man who can treat one another like this also be the one who is so creative to think up an episode that goes backwards and actually goes all the way backwards to Jerry meeting Kramer at the beginning of time? Have you seen that episode when they go to India? And that's in the late seasons, which people, after Larry David left, which people don't even like very much. But this idea that real hope does lie in humility, I think that there's... and laughter. Seinfeld is a show that if you take it seriously and if you find that yourself really identifying with it regularly, it is humbling. Because what about you finds these characters so funny? You see yourself in them. And if I can see myself in George Costanza, that's a humbling thing. Okay? Make no mistake, that's a humbling thing. And humility is something we're talking about here, but humility is actually rare. And it's a good thing. When we're humble, we can love another person. We're not expecting too much of other people. So although it's slightly depressing in its view, the very fact of its existence is encouraging. That's why I love it so much. That's probably why you like it so much. We're going to watch a clip that sums up some of the ethos of the show. And then we're going to watch an episode that I edited down and talk about the specific mechanics of these shows. Here we go.
All right. You want to know what one of her favorite expressions is? Happy, pappy?
Happy, pappy? Yeah. What does that mean?
Like if she wants to know if I'm pleased with something, she'll say, happy, pappy?
Oh, you're pappy.
I'm pappy.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
So that's not so bad.
Oh, come on. What are you kidding?
So tell her not to say it.
I'm much more comfortable criticizing people behind their backs. Anyway, look who's talking. You just broke up with Melanie last week because she shushed you while you were watching TV.
Hey, I got a real thing about shushing.
What is this? Did you ever get the feeling like you had a haircut but you didn't have one? I'm all itchy back here. What?
What is this? What are we doing? What in God's name are we doing?
What?
Our lives. What kind of lives are these? We're like children. We're not men.
No, we're not. We're not men.
We come up with all these stupid little reasons to break up with these women.
I know. That's what I do. That's what I do.
Are we going to be sitting here when we're 60 like two idiots?
We should be having dinner with our sons when we're 60.
We're pathetic. You know that?
Yeah, like I don't know that I'm pathetic.
Why can't I be normal?
Yes, me too. I want to be normal. Normal.
It would be nice to care about someone.
Yes. Yes. Care.
Okay, there they are. That's a rare moment of insight and kind of reflectiveness. And of course, by the end of the episode, they're right back to exactly what they'd always do. And that's just being silly and not really moving anywhere. One of the other things I want to say about Seinfeld before we watch this 10-minute clip is that the understanding that at the heart of human experience is this justification thing, that we are all lawyers internally. We are building cases against other people and for ourselves, or against ourselves and for other people. That this idea that Christianity, when you talk about justification by faith, that it's, you're talking about some 16th century thing that no one cares about. Oh, that's all been disproven, yada, yada, yada. No, not if Seinfeld's true. If Seinfeld's true, if saying anything, is that you and I are totally consumed with justification. Everything is about these little rules and our adherence to them and sussing out the laws of interpersonal communication, right? She shushed me, therefore I need to break up with her. You don't shush a person. I got a real thing about shushing. Oh, but her nicknames are ridiculous. I can't deal with that. She's not the person I want to be with. You don't think I'm pathetic? I know I'm pathetic. I see all the evidence. You know, they're bantering, they're sort of funny dealings with the little rules of etiquette. This tells me that they're just as obsessed with figuring out, right, how can I be justified? Where's, you know, what do I win this case or lose it? They're just as obsessed with it as I am. So one of the episodes, and this is from season 8, that really displays how the suffering, self-justification, the law in terms of trying to please another person, and the impossibility of love if you're relating to one another on those terms, if you're relating on a sort of a scorekeeping basis, one that illustrates it perfectly. And then the sort of nihilism that overlies all of it is the episode called the Andrea Doria. Anyone seen this episode? Well, George Costanza, the long-suffering St. Peter type, who's always saying the wrong thing and doing the thing that we kind of think we would like to do, he wants to get an apartment. His apartment in his building opens up, and he thinks it's going to be his. And they actually decide, the co-op board decides to give it to a man who was a survivor of the Andrea Doria shipwreck because he suffered more. And George, if we've learned anything through 8 seasons, is that he is a master sufferer. And so just watch his relationship with his own suffering, and as well as Elaine dealing with a relationship, and watch how she interacts. And maybe we can learn something about ourselves and about reality.
George, he's moving out.
Get out.
I'm out. Fantastic apartment right across from mine, huh? I can't wait for you to see.
Is it better than mine?
Oh, yeah.
So it's a 2-bedroom, 1-bath, make your friends hate you.
You know what? It's better than Elaine's, too. I gotta give her a call.
She's out.
Oh, right, the blind date.
Yeah, well, they like to call it a setup now. I guess the blind people don't like being associated with all those losers.
Come on, come check out my new place. Take you 2 minutes.
I can. I'm meeting Kramer down at my mini storage.
Hey, you got any extra furniture down there? I need some more stuff to fill that extra bedroom with a walk-in closet.
Oh, this is really annoying.
It's working already!
Excuse me, George.
No menus.
No, I'm Mrs. Riccardi, president of the Tenants Association.
Oh, right, right. Hey, I love the floors in here. It's like a gymnasium. Try and guard me. Come on.
George, unfortunately, Clarence Eldridge in 8C has decided that he wants the apartment.
But you promised it to me.
Yes, but you see, Mr. Eldridge is an Andrea Doria survivor. And in light of the terrible suffering that he's already been through, we've decided to give it to him.
Well, the Andrea Doria, it was quite a fire.
Shipwreck.
I remember it.
Is this guy? I hate this. I should have brought something to read. Cancer in laboratory animals.
Excuse me, Elaine Bennis?
Yeah.
And Alan Mercer called for you. He said he's sorry, but he won't be able to make it tonight. He's been stabbed.
Stabbed?
More bread?
Bread?
That is not the point. The guy was stabbed.
Did you find out who stabbed him?
Yeah. It turns out it was his ex-girlfriend.
Well, you're not going near this hooligan anymore.
Well, I don't know. I mean, think about it, Jerry. There must be something exciting about this guy if he can arouse that kind of passion. I mean, to be stab-worthy, you know, it's kind of a compliment.
Yeah, too bad he didn't get shot. He could have been the one.
Hey, how's everybody?
Hey.
There's no expiration date on this.
There is now. Kramer, you should really get that cough checked out by a doctor.
No. No doctors for me. Of lackeys and yes men all towing the company line. Plus, they botched my vasectomy.
They botched it?
I'm even more potent now.
Hey, how's the new place?
Gone. The tenant association made me give it to this guy because he was an Andrea Doria survivor.
Andrea Doria, isn't that the one they did the song about?
Edmund Fitzgerald.
I love Edmund Fitzgerald's voice.
No, Gordon Lightfoot was the singer. Edmund Fitzgerald was the ship.
You could fit 15 people in that bathroom.
I think Gordon Lightfoot was the boat.
Yeah, and it was rammed by the Cat Stevens.
And Andrea Doria collided with a Stockholm in dense fog 12 miles off the coast of Nantucket.
How do you know?
It's in my book, Astonishing Tales of the Sea. 51 people died.
51 people? That's it? I thought it was like 1,000.
1,660 survivors.
That's no tragedy. How many people do you lose on a normal cruise? 30, 40? Can I take a look at that book?
Oh, yeah. I also got Astounding Bear Attacks. Hey, before you go, did you talk to Newman about getting that mail out of there?
Yeah, oh, yeah. No, he's not going to do it.
I love shrimp. I'm a shrimp eater. You put shrimp in front of me, and I'll eat it till my stomach pops.
No, it's okay. I'm still just a little bit jumpy.
Between you and me, what happened there with the stabbing?
Just one of those things, you know.
What, was she just so crazy in love with you, she just couldn't take it anymore? Or...
I don't know.
Could be.
Alan?
Yeah. No, it was a different girl.
There was another crazed ex-girlfriend.
Right, so I called my friend, you know, the one who set us up. I found out he's a bad breaker-upper.
Bad how?
Well, you know, when you break up, how you say things you don't mean? Well, he says the mean things you don't mean, but he means them.
I follow. So what are you going to do?
Dump him. I can't be with someone who doesn't break up nicely. I mean, to me, that's one of the most important parts of a relationship.
What's more important? So that's it? We're breaking up?
What? Break up? We went out on one date.
Okay, yeah, sure, fine, right, whatever you say.
All right, good, good.
Okay then, well, so see you around. Big head.
Pardon?
You got a big head. It's too big for your body.
So, he's keeping the apartment. He doesn't deserve it, though. Even if he did suffer, that was like 40 years ago. What have you done for me lately? I've been suffering for the past 30 years, up to and including yesterday.
You know, if his tenant board is so impressed with suffering, maybe you should tell him the astonishing tales of Costanza.
I should.
I mean, your body of work in this field is unparalleled.
I could go bummer to bummer with anyone on this planet.
You're the man.
Jerry.
I'm with people. I'll be with you in a moment. So you want a protein shake or something?
I guess I should get moving on this, huh? I'm going to run.
So, Mom, Dad, I was hoping that you could help me to remember my childhood a little more clearly.
I feel a draft. Let's change tables.
Get out of here. We have a booth.
Frank, I'm cold.
Order a hot dish.
Why can't we sit over there?
That's not a booth.
So who says we have to sit in a booth?
I didn't take the subway all the way to New York to sit at a table like that.
No, I didn't take a subway to be in a drafty restaurant.
Now, George, what do you want to know about your childhood?
Actually, I think I'm pretty clear on it.
Where's that breeze coming from?
Just then, rescue ship emerged from the fog and saved us. It was the sweetest sight my eyes ever saw.
Thank you, Mr. Eldridge. The tenant board will now hear Mr. Costanza's testimony.
I was handcuffed to the bed in my underwear. Where I remained, for she certainly seemed interested in me. Though she was attractive, she was also, in fact, a Nazi. The water I had been swimming in was very cold. And when I dropped the towel, there had been significant shrinkage. My parents were looking at me. So there I was. And the marble rye hanging from the end of a fishing pole. In closing, these stories have not been embellished because they need no embellishment. They are simply, horrifyingly, the story of my life as a short, stocky, slow-witted, bald man. Thank you. Oh, also, my fiancé died from licking toxic envelopes that I picked out. Thanks again.
contest. The guy had nothing. The ship went down. He got into a lifeboat. Come on.
Well, he didn't know what he was up against. So when do you move into the apartment?
They're making the decision today.
What's the matter with you?
Nothing. Except that a bird ran into my giant freak head.
What giant freak head?
The one that sits atop my disproportionately puny body. I'm a walking candy apple.
So it's actually gotten to you? You're playing right into his hands.
What? Yeah, you're right. All I have to do is call him up and sit down with him and show him that it doesn't bother me. You know, laugh it off. Or jam a fork into his forehead.
Either way.
All right.
I want to apologize for her.
Oh, please.
I hope we can get past all this.
Oh, past? We're way past.
So you have a big head.
So what?
It goes well with the bump in your nose.
What?
Excuse me, what are you doing in there?
I'm moving in. Alan Mercer, new neighbor.
Elaine's big head guy? They gave you the apartment?
Yeah.
Why? Because you were stabbed and got coffee thrown in your face and...
Oh, fork in the forehead.
That's why they gave you the apartment?
No. Just gave the super 50 bucks.
Wait a minute. That is my apartment. I earned it with 34 years of misery.
Tough luck, Chinless.
So funny. And I think we can all agree that George, I mean, what other show would portray someone who actually has suffered so much at their very first opportunity using that suffering to clobber another person and to basically to justify himself? He's sitting there. It's a trial, right? Before the co-op board. He's saying, I've suffered this much, therefore I deserve such and such. And of course, George, by even using his suffering in this way, is showing how little he deserves anything. And then, but while he has suffered more than anyone else we know, and it's all self-inflicted or primarily self-inflicted, even that, though there's a verdict that says, okay, you'll get the apartment, then the monkey bite happens, and Elaine's guy comes in, and in fact, it reveals the whole thing to be a sham anyway by slipping the guy 50 bucks, and he gets the apartment. I mean, that is a dark view of life and of human nature, that there is no, that our suffering, even if when we try to moralize it and you draw some purpose out of it, even that doesn't even earn us anything. And then, of course, there's Elaine, who is latched on to the idea of someone who can give her a verdict about herself, right? Oh, he's a bad breaker-upper. Now I really want to date him. And they say, well, breaking up is the most important part of a relationship. I mean, this is really clever stuff. And that reveals the sort of hopelessness. Of course they're going to break up. That's a foregone conclusion. But here she's dying for a verdict. And she gets one and she laughs it off, and then a bird flies into her head, and slowly this verdict, this law, makes her more, what she shrugs off initially, as though it doesn't really matter, makes her more and more miserable until she wants to stab, you know, Mike talked about fight or flight or fight or appeasement. She stabs the guy in the forehead with a fork. I mean, this is the end result. And you may not be stabbing your partner in the face with a fork, but you've got resentments against the people that put verdicts on you. And you maybe are more passive aggressive, or hopefully you're married to someone or that you can talk to and really talk to and be honest with. But there's total honesty about the human condition in this show, but very little honesty when it comes to what's really going on between people in terms of love. You need to be loved in that place, or at least they don't believe that it's even possible. So what is the, why talk about this at this conference? Well, we are talking about honesty here. And as Aaron says, we need, the starting place needs to be one of honesty, and honesty for Christians as well. I don't know, I don't, in my experience, Christians don't relate to George Costanza less than non-Christians. That's, it's absurd to even think that. It's patently untrue. And in St. Peter, as I said, we do have the ultimate George Costanza. What happens in St. Peter's life? He's told to walk to Jesus on the water, and he drowns. He's the one who says, "Get behind me, Satan." To whom is said by Jesus, "Get behind me, Satan." In the Garden of Gethsemane, he's told to stay awake three times, and he falls asleep every time. Then, of course, Jesus tells him that he'll be denied three times. You can even see the Costanza in that. George is always out of self-interest denying things about his friends to weasel out of situations. But here, Jesus, this person that he loves, tells Peter that he's going to do it. And he does it three times. That's comic. Then, I always, my favorite bit of St. Peter is in John chapter 20. They hear the news of the empty tomb and they race to the tomb, he and the beloved disciple. And it's mentioned that Peter loses the race. He's a loser. Like Costanza. To me, George Costanza, if that is, he is the person who is in need of a savior. He cannot fix himself. He's stuck in patterns that seem to have a hold on him. He is in a whirlpool of self-interest and self-justification and genuine suffering. You look at the inheritance of sin. You know, we talk about the inheritance of sin. All you need to do to convince someone of the inheritance of sin, people don't want to talk about that. That's not a fashionable thing to say. Watch the scene with George and his parents at the table. That's inheritance of sin, done, period, over. Did George have a choice about who his parents were? Of course not. Original sin, handed down. It's no-brainer. But George is a person who's not in need of becoming a better George. He's not in need of some tips. He's in need of a total rescue. He's in need of an intervention. He's in need of a substitute. George is in need of a substitute. And I think Seinfeld, of course, takes the legal structure to its most terrifying conclusion in its finale, which I think was misunderstood. What Wyman says is that Larry David's semiotic coup in the final episode was to try, in a last parting burst, to get the audience to consider. To get the audience to consider the implications of a show about nothing that dominated the most powerful medium of its time. Finally, almost in desperation, he criminalized the act. The disconcerting closing episode made apparent that there would be no future, no fulfillment, and no redemption for the Seinfeld Four, nor for the viewers who watched the show. The character showed absolutely no remorse. And if you watch, the show ends with the same scene that it began, except for they're now in prison. There's a trial, and they're found guilty. These people need a substitute. They need a rescue. And that, to me, is if the gospel is for anyone, it's for George Costanza. If it's for anyone, it's for the Seinfeld Four. And I see myself in it. And I hope you do too. Again, Christian comedy is based upon the belief that all men are sinners. No one, therefore, whatever his rank or talents, can claim immunity from comic exposure. That's all I have to say about that. What time do we have? 11:30. What do we have? Any questions? Any thoughts? Yes. Have I written a book about this? No, I'm working on some essays about it though. We could also talk about how the Seinfeld Four are just overgrown children. Larry David, in interviews, says that they asked him how he finds his material, and he says he seeks out any any situation that will bring out his own immaturity. And then he says, like a funeral. And if you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I just want to make one comment about Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's the HBO show that is post Seinfeld for Larry David. And it's good, but it's a little too much. You know, one of the brilliant things about Seinfeld is that there were the network constraints on the show. They couldn't talk about certain things. They couldn't say certain words. They couldn't depict certain realities. And as a result, they found really creative ways to get around those things. And, you know, when people talk about, oh, what we need are no censorship at all. No, we need complete lack of constraint creatively. You want to say, listen to the music of the White Stripes and then watch Seinfeld. And I'm not even a White Stripes fan. But Seinfeld, when they couldn't talk about something like masturbation, which is a reality, just go to the sex addiction thing down the street. They thought of a very funny, interesting way to talk about it. But it was no less real. When they wanted to talk about abortion, they talked about it in terms of baking pizzas. I mean, they were forced to talk about things in really inventive ways. And I think, therefore, they kind of get around your defenses. And you were able to see yourself there. And they weren't making statements, because it's an anti-statement show, outside of the one statement, that there are no statements to be made. But I think this picture of people as children and regressive, stuck in their own habits and in their own ways, I mean, that's sinners in need of a savior. Crash course. Scott. Scott just asked if there's any, what I think of Seinfeld in light of Portlandia. Portlandia is a show that is lampooning a sort of the culture that is embodied in Portland, Oregon, that is insistence upon, I guess, tolerance, but underneath it lies the most strict rules that you could possibly imagine. And it's shown over and over again that the rightness and wrongness of even recycling becomes something by which people are condemned. What Freud called the narcissism of small differences. That when things are actually going okay, then we have to find ever increasingly silly ways of differentiating ourselves from one another and finding our own righteousness. I think Portlandia is more of a political show. And I mean, it does have this human condition thing down. That life is about justification, and that we are trying to feel good about ourselves based upon our attributes, our causes, our behaviors, and it shows this in a ridiculous amount of funny ways. You know, what's the right bird to eat? You know, okay, I want to know this chicken's name. Did it have friends? Was it where was it locally fed? But was the person who gave him the last meal? Was it a compassionate meal? That sort of thing, and they go through it. And, you know, plenty of shows, I guess, are done lampooning conservatives. And this one is one sort of lampooning, I guess, self-described progressives, saying that whether you're on the far right or the far left, the man-made laws are prisons. And there is no – the logical end is always a church of one rather than – all believers, which I think Seinfeld is much more about, that we're all sort of the baseline of human suffering and self-interest, upon which, come to find out, there is moments of grace, of love, of lucky breaks. But if we're putting the baseline up here, that people are basically good and they're it's just a matter of sort of being educated enough or getting in the right circumstance, and people are constantly disappointed, you're constantly disappointed. But if you actually believe people aren't really free, that they're judging each other helplessly all the time, but then you have this a moment of grace or love, and those things do happen, I think you can live a more grateful life rather than a life of bitterness, essentially, if you have an inflated view. So that's what Seinfeld does for me. It makes me a grateful person. And not just grateful that I'm not like them, but grateful that I am like them and that God loves me in that. Any other thoughts? McDavid. Newman. Newman is just a hilarious construct. He's a postman who's... you know, there's a lot of studies that have been out recently that it actually people are happier if they have a few enemies. Do you know that? It's like clarifies their life. And I don't think the people on Seinfeld, Newman is not somehow more evil than or self-interested than anyone else. He's just kind of despicable in his own peculiar way. So it provides a great comic dimension to have a nemesis. And Newman, if you watch the show, Newman's sometimes helping, sometimes hurting. And just like all the other characters, given the slightest opportunity, they will work against each other. It just makes for so many funny situations. What else? Jason? Any pictures of grace or hope in Seinfeld? There's a great episode. I think it's profoundly hopeful in the sense that it doesn't look for hope in other people. And therefore, it might create a situation, if you take it seriously, where you would look for hope outside of other people, maybe in God. There's a great episode. Maybe Jerry falls in love with Janine Garofalo, who is exactly like him. He finds out they go to the diner and they both order cereal. And they both sort of have that sort of, hey, what's the deal with this? What's the deal with brunch? Well, how come there's no Lupper? And they think it's so funny. But Jerry falls in love with this person. And then he realizes, in his amazing clip, he says, I realize what I've been looking for all along. Myself. I've been looking for myself. And then, later on in the exact same episode, because it's Seinfeld, he decides not to get... and they get engaged, and then, or he thinks he's going to marry this person. Later on in the exact same episode, he said, but then I realized I hate myself. And that's really refreshing. You know, don't we, in our relationships, want to turn... We hold it against the other person that they're not more like us all the time, or they're not acting in the ways we would see things the way we would. And Seinfeld knows this, and it says that there is a part of the human being that is bent in on itself and trying to make other people in its own image, especially our closest ones. But then there's this conflicting truth that we're bent in and broken, and when we actually experience the reality of ourselves, we don't like it. And there again, you're looking for something that is not you. Maybe you can have a spouse who it's okay that they're different from you. So, but instances of grace, I mean, the show is adamantly against grace. I mean, it reveals the end point of this behavior, which is, I hate to say it, Auden said another thing. He said, all sin is addiction and the end point of addiction is damnation. But this is the scene that Larry David, when he puts a moral pronouncement on their actions in the final episode, he's saying that the way we treat people is actually not this sort of self-interest. It's funny, but it's not neutral. Just because everyone's like this doesn't make it okay. And you know, that thing that Aaron was saying, you know, oh, we're just all human. Hey, nobody's perfect. There's truth in that. But that's not somehow, that doesn't exonerate us. It still hurts when someone sells you out. It still hurts when you get rejected. And these things are not good. And so Larry David, in a kind of a brilliant move at the end, again, he pronounces a judgment on these people. they get a verdict, and it's in a courtroom, and it turns out they are helpless, like they have no defense. All they have is the entire cast of all the seasons, basically all the guest stars, comes forward and testifies against these people. And it is, I don't understand why Christian ministers don't use that episode more often, like in youth ministry settings, you know, where we talk about, when I was a youth minister, we always talked about, okay, if imagine you're like Albert Brooks and you're sort of on trial for your life in heaven, and they have a DVD of your life and all the sort of the subtitles of your thoughts, and no one would ever want to see that, and we'd all want to hide from that. But that's what God, where God is, and that he enters into the moment, the point of darkness and impasse. But that is what the closing episode of Seinfeld is. And these people don't have remorse. And, you know, like there's it takes it to its logical conclusion, and I respect that. I respect that it takes morality somewhat seriously, and it takes this sort of treatment of oneself and other people. It takes it seriously, and it finds them that they're actually physically in prison. How more could you say it? And people hated it because it pronounced judgment, and who wants that? But at the same time, it wasn't exactly, it was, you know, if these people had really existed in real life, the parade of witnesses, you and I would have a parade of witnesses coming up. And the fact is that we're sprung from jail, not before we show remorse, but while we're still sinners, you know? Those characters don't show remorse. That's a nihilistic thing, but it's reality. A lot of times we you know, think about in your marriage, you say sorry for some things, but your spouse wants you to say sorry for the things you're not sorry for, and you want them to say sorry for things that they're saying sorry for some stuff, but not the right stuff, you know? If salvation, if grace was in a matter of us repenting correctly, being able to say sorry for all the things that are specifically we've done wrong, then none of us would ever be saved. There'd be no good news. But the good news is that when Jerry and George and Kramer and Elaine are sitting in the cell replaying the same conversation that started off the series, having shown no remorse about the verdict that's been passed on them, that's actually where God meets you and me. And I think that's like a... I don't understand why youth ministers don't use that. Maybe it's too gaudy. Anne. No, I agree. I agree, absolutely. Comedy is grace because it gives you permission to say, I don't have it all together. I'm just like this person. And anytime you can do that, then you're in a place where God is present. You know, that's... And I think like the no hugging, no learning policy, the sort of people never change. I think what Seinfeld illustrates so perfectly in a lot of like young adult or there's a lot of those Diablo Cody movies is that people don't change, at least not according to effort. People are changed by things that happen to them, by something outside of themselves, essentially. And so I do believe in the Holy Spirit, and I do believe in God's ability to work in a person's life, but I don't believe it ever happens as a result of some sort of engineering or exertion. And that's what that show shows. In fact, their efforts to change often make the problems worse. And so there's something deeply hopeful about it. And Curb Your Enthusiasm, I think you're right. I think the absence of censorship actually plays against the show, and I also, because it gets really crude and really disgusting in a way that seems to glorify the behavior more than Seinfeld, which seems to laugh at it. And maybe that was Jerry Seinfeld's presence in the show. I don't know. And it is, you're right, a little more predictable and less creative because it didn't have those walls to work with. Again, and you know, it helps us to laugh at ourselves. I think. What does God's grace tell us? If we are actually saved in spite of ourselves and according to what He has done, then we're given permission to go into those regressive places of our lives, to shine the light there, and to be honest. And we all know that if you're not honest, things tend to get worse. Let's say one thing then, Joseph. one of my favorite formulations is that the law of God says, I'll love you when or if you meet my standards. And that's what every single Seinfeld relationship is about. I will love you if you just don't have man hands. You know, I will love you if you don't have the fungal cream, in mysterious fungal cream in your cabinet. I will love you, or for with George, if you don't have the chocolate sauce all over your face. So the law says, I will love you when or if you meet my standard. But the gospel says, I'll love you in spite of the fact that you may not. And I've got one other clip I want to show, but Joseph, what would you... Yeah. And maybe your life is that your experience as a Christian or your experience of other Christians is essentially nine seasons of regressive tendencies that where you're right back at the beginning where you started. In fact, maybe you're even worse, you're in prison. I mean, that is, and that God is actually, that hasn't compromised his love or his grace. That is a profoundly moving statement. Now we're going to watch what is probably the ultimate anthropological statement of Seinfeld. I've put it on the website many times, but I just felt it's the right one to close with. It's the great George Costanza, it's not you, it's me situation. Here we go.
Hey. You know what? A friend of mine from work said that she saw George at the tennis match on TV yesterday.
Yeah, me too. Hey, he was at the snack bar eating a hot fudge sundae. He had it all over his face. He's wearing that chocolate on his face like a beard, and they got in there really nice and tight, and he's...
I'm sorry, George.
But I don't understand. Things were going so great. What happened? Something must have happened.
It's not you. It's me.
You're giving me the it's not you, it's me routine? I invented it's not you, it's me. Nobody tells me it's them, not me. If it's anybody, it's me.
All right. George, it's you.
You're damn right it's me.
Look, I was just trying to,
you know... I know what you were trying to do. Nobody does it better than me.
Well, I'm sure you do it very well.
Yes, well, unfortunately, you'll never get the chance to find out.
But I thought things were going great.
Yeah, so did I.
Did she say why?
No. She tried to give me the it's not you, it's me routine.
But that's your routine.
Yeah. Well, apparently word's out.
Hey, Georgie, I saw you on TV yesterday.
Really, at the tennis match?
Yeah, you were at the snack bar eating a hot fudge sundae.
Get out of here. I didn't see any cameras there.
Oh, the camera was whoom, there. And the announcers, they made a couple of cracks about you.
Cracks? What were they saying?
That you had ice cream all over your face. They were talking about how funny you looked.
Oh, God. Maybe Gwen saw it. Maybe that's what did it.
Well, I tell you, it wasn't a pretty sight.
She must have seen me eating it on TV.
So she sees you with hot fudge on your face and she ends it? Do you really think she'd be that superficial?
Why not? I would be.
Hello? Oh, hi, Dad. You saw him? Really? With the ice cream?
All right, I'll talk to you later.
But your parents saw me on TV?
Yeah.
This is a nightmare. Kramer, how long was I up?
It felt like 8 seconds.
One thousand two.
I heard you really inhaled that thing. Did anyone tape it?
Can we move on?
He thinks Gwen broke up with him because she saw him eating the ice cream on TV.
Oh, come on. If she's that superficial, you don't want her.
Yes, I do.
So I guess you're not going to Todd's party on Friday.
Well, I can't now. Gwen's going to be there.
Well, she should be the one that shouldn't go.
Well, if a couple breaks up and they had plans to go to a neutral place, who withdraws? What's the etiquette?
Excellent question.
I mean, I think she should withdraw. She's the breaker. He's the breakee. He needs to get on with his life.
I beg to differ.
Really?
He's the loser.
Ah.
She's the victor.
Uh-huh.
To the victor belong the spoils.
Well, I don't care. I don't want to go anyway.
I don't want to fight that traffic on Friday night.
Well, we can take the car service from my office.
Really?
Yeah, they don't know.
All right, I'll see you later.
Okay.
Hey, Georgie.
To the victory again.
Okay, so we're at the end here. All I'm saying is that I believe that grace does give us the permission to laugh at ourselves. And, you know, Christians are not really known for their sense of humor about themselves. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we took God's grace so seriously that we could watch our own, you know, shooting ourselves in the foot and silly, regressive tendencies and chuckle a little bit. It might actually make them less pronounced, at least when it comes to ourselves. I really do believe that. So that's a breakout session about nothing. Thanks for coming. Lunch is served downstairs, I think, in about 5 minutes. Yada, yada, yada.